Thank you, Marianne, and good afternoon to all of you following this conference here on we will call for this conference at the UNIPEC having signed our access agreement in India. So this is the background for why we have brought forward this conference this afternoon. We will, as Marianne said, share in the presentation here, and Sigve, myself, and Trond will be available for questions and answers from those holding here as well as those following us in the conference. We will go through this with the ambition of forming a transaction update. We will, Sigurd will go through the investment case and the considerations around that. And hopefully we will be able to bring forward the options that will enable you to make the evaluations of these cases with the viewpoints that we are giving you. India is a huge continent. It is not a country as such. It has more than 1.1 billion people, and it's growing. We see this as a growth opportunity, along with the growth project that Telenor has been carrying through over the last 10 to 15 years, when we really have built our footprint outside Norway and Scandinavia the way we've done. For us, this is a long-term project, as many other of the long-term projects that we have been in before. And those of you that have followed us will know exactly that. We feel that the industrial development of Telenor over these years have created a solid competence base on how to work in a business environment and market environment the way we see India developing from now and into the future. And of course it is the low penetration factor in India that attracts us. This is in the midst of the communicated strategy of Telenor. Lastly, at our Capital Markets Day in 2008. In this concept, of course, the Telenor Group has established a lot of competencies, a lot of practices that we intend to reuse, copy, put into new execution with new efficiencies. Because there will be a different operating model in India than we have been used to. And one of those important elements is, of course, the power sharing arrangement, which is now clear in India with new with a new vendor. We have entered UNIPEC Wireless with a deal which is not closed yet. We did that the 28th of October. Since then, we have been working on the very important cost parameters in the business model that UNIPEC Wireless will be executing upon. We've taken a 60% stake, and all the money that we are injecting into this company will be for the company. This is not a shareholding purchase, it's a capital extension for UNIPEC Wireless, with the exception of a minor shareholder loan. The expected closing is to take place during first quarter. And in this agreement, we will, from the Telenor perspective, have the full managerial control from day one on this project. This is important for us that we enter a project with the very well-defined strategic partnership, the industry relationship and the strategic partnership that we now do with Unitech Group. And holding of 60% requires authorization and approval by the authorities. So during the coming after closing, the coming period after closing, the application for such an approval will be submitted to the Foreign Investment Promotion Board. And if we refer to similar projects and practices in India, we don't expect any challenges on getting such an approval. From a financing point of view, transaction involves that we will inject 8.7 billion worth of Norwegian crowns in the first period of this transaction. And this will be done in three legs. One then after closing in first quarter, and then gradually build up according to the needs of the project within the first year of operation. In addition to the first three tranches, as you can see on the board here, there is a shareholder loan that will be converted from Unitech Group to equity, and to compensate for that, there will be another element of 3.75 billion Indian rupee, equivalent to $150 million approximately, that will come from Telenor. And this adds up to 8.7 billion Norwegian crowns in the initial period. When we informed the market about the deal in October, Unitech Wireless has received spectrum in 13 circles. This has now grown to 21 circles. There is only now one missing circle. This is Delhi. In the Delhi, there is an ongoing process for spectrum release. Our concern in this respect is that since there is a big variation on penetration and market setup in the different circles, we are not focusing on the Delhi area in the first round. Also because of the fact that Delhi has already a high penetration. The spectrum allocated to each operator in India is a very slim package, only 4.4 megahertz to start with. And it is evenly distributed among the operators in such a way that when customer base grows and volumes grows, then you can apply for new spectrum packages on top of the initial ones. But the end result of this is still that all operators have the common feature that there are limitations on spectrum. The power sharing agreement with Tata and Quipu is now in place. This was signed on Wednesday. And forms one of those milestones that had to be reached in the condition precedent sheet of the deal as it was presented in October. The power sharing agreement that now is in place gives Unitech Wireless an access to 40,000 sites approximately, out of which 22,000 sites is already up and running. The remainder of the sites needs to be built. And in this setup, there are then ourselves and others that will be the potential users of the remaining sites here. And Sigurd will bring forward how the finance mechanics of the power sharing agreements will work and how it will play into our profit and loss and CapEx figures in his presentation. This has then a commitment from the tower vendor to be in operation for 20 years and with the possibilities of extensions, whereas from the user's point of view, the commitment is not of that long period. So there are flexibility on the tower sharing arrangements longer term, which also will be described more in detail by Sigve. Then I think I'm come to the stage that I will leave to Mr. Sigve Brekke to take you through the investment case as it stands presently. Sigve has been with Telenor in Asia for more than 10 years. He has seen all our project developments in the company. He's been CEO of DTAC for quite a period, and he's now the regional head residing in Bangkok, and obviously also the main driver for bringing Telenor forward in the Indian project. Sigve, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Fredrik, and good afternoon to all of you. Having spent now most of the last 6 months together with a big Telenor team in India, I will say that we have learned quite a lot on the Indian market and also been able to prepare ourselves quite in a good way to how do we want to address this market and what is our go-to-market strategy. What I'm going to go through now used to do, and hopefully that will be some help to your model. Let me start with a little bit on the Indian market. This slide is just to show how we see the Indian GDP to grow. The dotted line is how we saw it back in October when we presented the slide, presented the case, and you see now that we forecast a little bit slower growth in 2009, but picking up again in the end of 2010 and onwards. So, relatively speaking, India will be less affected by the global financial crisis than many other countries. So, over a period of 5 years, 2008 to 2013, we foresee that the GDP growth in India is actually going to be in the range of 80%, which makes India then growing up to the ninth biggest economy in the world. This is just a slide showing how big the potential in India is. Out of the two biggest markets in the world, China and India is still lower on penetration, with a penetration of about around 30%, which means that there are 800 million people that still are not connected in India. And I would claim that if you want to be a global operator and position yourself for the growth, coming growth, India is a place that you just have to be. Of course, not all of these 800 million people will end up as a mobile customer. But I would claim that most of these people, up to 8% penetration, will, in some years to come, have a mobile phone. So India is, in my view, having the ambition of being a global telco in the growth market, a place we need to be in. This graph is showing how we see that the percentage of mobile spending as percentage of the GDP is going to develop. This is Telenor assumption. It's coming from a couple of factors. The first factor, of course, is taking into account the GDP growth that I just showed you. The second factor is the penetration that we forecast to come in a few years to come. And we see that when the penetration goes up, the percentage spending of GDP used for mobile is also going up. Taking benchmark countries like Ukraine, for example, Thailand or Malaysia, all these three countries with a high penetration has a mobile spending of GDP to between 3 to 3.5%. We have been a little bit more conservative on this when it comes to India, so we feel that in the range of 2.4% is what we will see in India in some years to come when the penetration is going up. We have made this assumption on the penetration, closing up with
75-80% in a 10-year time. We don't see why India shouldn't follow the same curve as we see in many other countries. Being Thailand with close to 100%, being Ukraine as another growth market with more than 100%, being Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, and so on. And we think that with the current competition and the future competition in India, we'll, and also with the offerings and the prices that we currently see, will drive the penetration up to this level. Of course, this is not 80% of the population having mobile phone. Some of this will also be double SIM, as we see in other growth markets. We have made this RPU assumption that is based on three, four different arguments. The first one is that the price is already, also the price reduction is more or less already taken out in the Indian market. Over the last three, 4 years, we have seen a fall in the prices, which now leaves India as one of the cheapest markets in the world in terms of per minute, how much you pay per minute. So we don't see the dramatic fall in prices going forward as we have seen in other markets. That's one. The second one is that the incumbents in India also have this spectrum limitation, as Fredrik already explained, which means that the big operators, there is no way that they can dump the prices further. And there is no way that they can play a game where you give away a lot of free minutes. Because you simply don't have spectrum enough to handle all that traffic. The third argument I would use is that the percentage of data services out of the total revenues in the industry as such is quite low. We're talking about 3-4% of the total revenues coming from value-added services or data usage. While in other growth markets, we see this percentage being in the range of 12-15%. So we foresee that also the Indian customers is going to use data services more. Everything from SMS to more advanced services. And my fourth argument would then be that knowing the growth in the GDP and knowing also the growth in mobile spending as a percentage of the GDP, we believe in this ARPU development. This is an ARPU development based in local currency, in rupees. India is not a country in the way that we like to look at the country. It's more a continent. And you really have to break down this huge continent into much smaller parts. India is divided into 22 circles, and we have got spectrum in 21 out of these 22 circles. And if you look at these circles, you have the metros, also the cities, you have the A, B, and C circles. And there is quite a huge variation between the different circles. It's a huge variation in terms of how developed the market is, also the penetration. It's a big variation in terms of the culture, the local marketing, the language, and so on. So if you want to do business in India, you actually need to do business in each and one of these circles, not only look at India as a whole. And that is also what this slide is showing. Out of the seven operators we have in India today, five of them haven't had Indian presence after they are present in all the 22 circles. But you see that even the market leader, Airtel, with a market leader of 25% market share, they have a number one position only in eight of the 22 circles, and so on and so forth. So if you go into the circle level there, you will find a very different picture. In some of the circles, the competition is much, much lower, only a competition among two or three of the players. While in the metros and in the cities, the competition, of course, is higher. So when we look at India and when we develop our growth to the market strategy, we have gone down to the circle level. And we see then that when we do that, there is a position that can be taken, but different between circle and circle. And I will also claim that seeing this picture, having seven operators in a huge continent as India, whereby five of them are nationwide, is not that different from what we see in markets like Pakistan, for example. We entered the Pakistani market as number five or number six. Today we are number two. Grameen and Bangladesh is another example. Also four or five players. Thailand is the third example, four players. So in much smaller markets, we also see competition which is very similar to what we see in India. Of course, some of these guys are very good. There's no doubt about that. But I wouldn't buy the argument that India is overcrowded or too competitive. India is a very typical mass market. A mass market where you have 10 to 11 million net subscribers coming every month. And the operators have more than enough just taking these new subscribers on board. So it's a typical, what I would call, a pull market, where you go on TV and advertising, and you get the customers to run to buy your service. But it's not a market where you have advanced segmentation models. It's not a market where you have very advanced distribution systems. It's not a market where you have a very high service quality either. And this slide is showing some of that. It shows on the left side here some of the technical parameters. For example, when you set up a call or when you try to get connected, in India the average is 1.46, while the European average is 0.54. In the four Asian Telenor operations, our average is around 0.6. Or the drop call statistics. Also, 3 out of 5 users are experiencing drops during a conversation. And you also see on the other side of this slide that customers are generally unhappy with the service that they get. And there is no surprise then that the churn level is very high. The loyalty in the Indian market among the customers are relatively low. Currently, their churn is up around 45 to 50%. So around 50% of the customers are changing operators every year. And that's the same as we see in other growth markets. This is even higher in markets like Thailand, for example, or in Malaysia. And this is a big opportunity for us as a newcomer. So when I see that some people are looking at our ability to take the really new customers in the C-circle, up in the low penetrated area, that's only half of the picture. The churning customers is even more interesting for us to take a look at. And knowing that there is a rotation of half of the customer base every year, it's a huge opportunity for a newcomer to position ourselves with a different value proposition than the current players have. That was a little bit about the market. Let me now go to how we plan to address this market and how we plan to position ourselves. As you know, we have been working in Asia since 1997, when we launched Grameenphone in Bangladesh. And then we added Digi in 1999, DTAC in Thailand in 2000, and then Pakistan in some years thereafter. So we have had actually more than 10 years experience from working in very similar markets, as we see in India. Of course, smaller markets, but very similar in the way that the market dynamics work. And we are going to reuse a lot of these concepts that we have tried out in these four operations, reuse them in India. And especially in these four areas that I'm mentioning on this slide. One, distribution. Two, segmented offering. Three, CRM solutions, or keep the customers on board and avoid churn. And four, the organizational culture. The culture and the way of work that Telenor has been introducing in this market. And let me go a little bit more into this area. The first one being distribution. This is an area where most people don't really pay notice to. In the emerging markets, this is a very important area because it's so important that you get close to the customers. And most of these customers are prepaid customers, and they actually go and top up their prepaid card very frequently, as you do on a daily basis. Which means that there is a customer contact much more frequently than you have in the more advanced market. Which means that the one that actually are able to control distribution has a potential of differentiating himself. The traditional distribution model is that the operator is selling the SIM cards or selling the scratch cards to a wholesaler. The wholesaler is selling to a sub-wholesaler. The sub-wholesaler is selling to another sub-wholesaler, which is then selling to the retailer. We plan to do this differently. We plan to actually, as an operator, go directly to the retail level. We have done that in our other operations as well. What that does is that you get much closer to the customer. And you can change this pull model, as I explained, to a push model. You can actually, in a greater extent, push your product into the hand of the customer. And that is one thing that we have been very successful in these other Asian markets. Going down to the retail level, being able to influence actually the retailers arguments when they are selling or pushing our product in the hand of customers. And we are trying to do that in a big scale. 1 million retailers in 3 years' time. That sounds like a big number. Just to compare it, in Thailand there is 120,000 retailers. In Bangladesh it's around the same, 110,000 retailers, which we have developed a direct relationship to. And this we are going to use in India also. And we feel that this is going to give us a competitive advantage, which is a little bit difficult for the incumbents to respond to, because they already have an established relationship to this wholesaler traditional distribution system. Segmentation. In the Indian market, as a typical mass market, there is no advanced segmentation the way we see it. We are going to reuse some of the concepts that we have been using in other markets. And I have picked 3 examples here. One up to the right corner, D-Juice. D-Juice is a brand that we have been using in several of the Telenor markets for the youth segment. It's a different way of branding ourselves. It's a different value proposition. Also, there are different types of services and applications that we give out. And there it's also different price plans. We have been using this and going to use this in India as well. Another example is the guy you see in the middle. Also, a segmented offer for the SMU market, which is in India, in all Asian markets, is a very big proportion of the small family companies and also bigger. And the third one, Lowter, is an example from Malaysia, where it's a specific offer for the foreign workers that work in Malaysia. All this is an example of segmentation of the market that we think can give us an upper hand in the Indian competition if we reuse some of the concepts. This is another example of customer lifecycle management. Everyone is doing that for the high-end customers. Everyone is doing that for postpaid or for the corporate customers. But very few are doing this for the mass market customers. And in markets like India, we know that 90% of the customers are prepaid customers. And very few have actually implemented CRM solutions for this segment. We have done that in other markets as well. And what that does is that it enables you to have a lower churn than your competitors do. It enables you to when people play around with several SIM cards, to try to have your SIM card into the phone longer time than you have your competitors. And it enables you also to develop the ARPU. The examples we have been using here is services like a loyalty program, so you give out bonuses to prepaid customers. It's example like you can borrow money if you are out of money on the prepaid card. It's things like ATM SIM, where you actually have an ATM set up on your SIM card and you can do everything but withdrawing money. All these are examples of things you can do with prepaid customers, which we currently don't see in the Indian market. And that will enable us to both protect our ARPU and also reduce our churn. Combined this, we have made this assumption on our subscriber market share. Again, also we are going to target the churning customers. Even more important for us than to target the really, really new customers. Because the new customers are coming in areas which we don't have a coverage from day one. And they're also coming in on a lower profitability level or a lower ARPU level. So we are going to target the churning customers. So we will take a higher proportion of the growth ads. And we see that in 10 years' time, you should be able to have an 8% or more market share. We don't see why that shouldn't happen. And again, with experiences that we have from other markets, Pakistan maybe being the most recent one. Let me then go into some numbers. And I'm going now to give you, as I said, a little bit more detail than what we used to do, because we would like you to help you a little bit on the modeling. It's a oversimplification of some of the numbers, but I'm going to go through it anyway to give some indications. We need to have a very low-cost operating model if we want to succeed in the Indian market. There's no doubt about that. The big incumbent has scale advantages, so we have to have a cost model which is more, at least equal or less expensive than the other competitors have. That's why we now have a network model which is going to be built up gradually. I'm coming back to that. That's why we are basing it on infrastructure sharing instead of building our own towers. That's why we are now negotiating GSM contracts with GSM vendors to very competitive costs. We do a full-scale IT outsourcing. And we plan then to have a long-term cost and CapEx efficiency. So the plan here is to try to have a cost model which is better than our competitors have in the market. The rollout plan is that we plan to start with a 20,000 sale price when we start operation. That will cover approximately 40% of the population. Then we scale up to 30,000 base station cell sites, which will cover 50, and then within 2010, we plan to have 40,000 sites, which will cover around 60% of the population. That will, in our view, make us competitive. The three of the bigger players in the market have more cell sites like this than the 60,000, than the 40,000, but the rest have fewer. So with that footprint, we our opinion is that we are fully competitive with other players in the market. And this is going to be scaled up very rapidly. So having this access to this new tower rental agreement is not only giving us a lower CapEx figure, it's also enabling us to launch our services much quicker. On top of that, we are also working with inter-circle roaming, which means that even if you don't launch or have a network in one circle, you can utilize one of your competitors' networks. That is regulated by the regulator, and we have this as an agreement in place already. On top of that, we are also working with what we call intra-circle roaming, which is within the circle. We have not made any agreement on that yet, but we hope to get that in place also in the months to come. The Tata Kripo tower agreement is arranged in such a way that we get access up to 40,000 towers. But we are not committed to take all these towers. They have currently 22,000 physical towers, and they are obligated in the contract to build them the balance up to 40,000 over the coming 18 months. We feel that we have a very competitive commercial agreement here in terms of what we pay per site per month. And we also feel that this gives us flexibility. It gives us enough towers to actually roll out our services, as I showed on the previous page. But it also gives us flexibility to go with other tower vendors if that is a better option for us. Right now, there is, as far as we see it, an oversupply of towers in the market, which is a very different situation compared with what it was just a year ago. And we feel that this is probably going to drive down the prices even more in the years to come. And that's why it's very important for us to have this flexibility, that we can also go with other tower vendors if we find that as even better suited to our needs. In this agreement, it's not only about access rents of access to towers, it's also including transmission. Just to illustrate what that means in numbers, this slide is comparing building a tower with renting a tower. The building here is just the tower. It's not including the core part of the network, switches and all that. It's just the tower plus the radio equipment on the tower. If you build that yourself, the cost is approximately $80,000. If you rent it, the cost is approximately $22,000, which is the radio equipment that you have to invest in. So this is actually a 75% cheaper solution to go with this rental principle rather than building the towers yourself. And with the tower agreements we have in place now, we feel that we don't actually have to build much tower ourselves. Then you may argue that, okay, you save CapEx, but you will get it all back on OpEx, which is not the case. What this is showing is that there is, on the OPEX side, there is a slight higher OPEX cost if you go with rental than if you have built yourself. But it depends how many tenants you have on the tower. If you are the only tenant on the tower, it will be slight higher. But the break-even here is between 2 and 3 tenants. If there is more than 2.5 or 3 tenants, the cost is actually becomes lower, because there are more people to share the costs on. And the tower agreement we have, we pay a higher rental fee if we are the first tenant, and then when the second comes in, it's lower, and the third comes in, it's lower. That's the way this is set up. We are just about to close our negotiation with the GSM vendors. We are going, what we are seeing now is prices which is lower than we ever have seen before in the Telenor portfolio. And we think that with the group leverage we have in Telenor now and with the opportunity that this also means for GSM vendors in India, we will get prices that is lower than what we have paid before and also what our competitors have invested in. And the same comes to the IT side. We are also just about to close a contract with an IT vendor. And what we see now is in the range of 3% of the revenues that we have to pay as an IT cost, which is significantly lower than the world average. And the main difference here, of course, is that IT is very competitive in India. So the offers you get in India is significantly cheaper than you get in the rest of the world. This slide is showing you some of the other cost parameters that you may need in your modeling. It's oversimplified, but I would like to just go through it. On the customer acquisition cost, we assume in the range of 250 to 300 rupees per customer. India is a market with churn topic, so we don't feel that any of the operators will start to subsidize neither handset or actually try to do something which will bring these costs up a lot. And similar we have seen in other markets. On the marketing side, of course, we were going to be higher the first 2 years until we have launched and established ourselves. Over time, we will see a 3% of revenues for marketing. And then on the admin call center, we will see around 10% over time. And on the regulatory side, regulatory fees, then in the range of 30%. The lower part of this chart is showing how much it will cost per site. So the agreement that we have is then the tower rental plus the transmission. On top of that, we have to pay electricity and diesel also, and of course also the O&M. And combined, we foresee that this will cost us approximately 70,000 rupees per month per sales site, which I guess if you benchmark, it's a very competitive number. On the CapEx, of course, in the beginning, the CapEx to sales will be high, and it's mainly driven by new coverage, around 30,000 US dollars per site. Then, when we start loading customers, the CapEx, of course, will be driven by the capacity needs, around 20 US dollars per ad. And then, when we move into a steady state, we foresee that the CapEx to sales should be in the range of 10%. That's our target. The last slide I have is saying a little, on the outlook. I think you have seen these numbers already. We are now guiding for EBITDA figures, which are different, and also CapEx figures, which are different. The main difference here on EBITDA is that we are a little bit later now with our launch plan than we were back in October. But it's also that our rental agreement with Tata Tipo is cheaper than we expected back in October. The IT agreement that they're working on also looks very favorable. And on the CapEx side, it's fewer or no sites that we are going to build ourselves. Plus, that we see that the prices that we get from the GSM vendors are cheaper than we actually expected back in October. So that's the main reason why these numbers now look a little bit better than they did back in October. We maintain our ambition of a 30% EBITDA margin long term and a 10% operating cash flow margin. And with that, I hand back to Eric.
Thank you, Sigve. A comprehensive package of information there. On the other hand, I know that even that probably raises questions, so we'll come back to questions of that there in some few minutes. But allow me to go through the financing considerations before we do the Q&A.
The financing plan for Unitech Wireless is so that the investment case assumes a cumulative funding of approximately 22 billion Norwegian crowns until operating capital break even after around 5 years after launch. The funding requirements the first year is then covered by the equity input that we've done and which I showed you at the beginning of this presentation. The further financing will then be project financing, vendor financing, and if necessary, additional equity during the course of the development of the project. Both Telenor and Unitech are contractually committed to provide the pro rata share of that additional equity needed, if needed, compared to the other elements in the financing plan in the years to come. There have been questions raised around the ability of our partner to raise this, and to that question I can say that the commitments are clear. Unitech is in the midst of doing their refinancing on their balance sheet in these days, and they have a plan of milestones to execute that during 2009. We are of the opinion that if that financing plan can, restructuring plan will be carried out, that the commitments potentially there will be met also by the Unitech price. Further in-depth analysis of that cannot be given by me, but must be given by the Unitech owners. Then lastly, and in summary, I want to highlight sort of the core of this project. We are of course aware of the fact that we are putting a lot of strain on the investors' views on Telenor in this period. However, we are in the midst of building up Telenor over many, many years here, and the elements that we have put at the platform for this decision is of course the strategy that has been so clear for Telenor over the years, namely that of participating in growth in new markets. And with our presence in India over more than 10 years, we have built up competencies which are exactly what we do believe is the case for India in the next 3 to 4 years, when penetration is obviously to develop from the present around 30% and probably will double in that period of time. So the strategy on that should be very clear also from sort of the experience of the group over the last years. The experience that we have built up in the group clearly shows that we have a lot of people now which are eager to get started on this. At this occasion, we are not disclosing the management combination in this project. That will come later. But within the group, there are capacities to handle also such a step up of our activities in Asia. And this doesn't mean that there will only be people from Norway sort of doing the things in India. On the contrary, this will be a group built competencies that now will be put into a new project. And having then seen the financing structure being revised from a rights issue to be taken care of on the existing balance sheet of Telenor, we feel that we have the necessary elements in place to move further on this project. The business case as such, the number of players in the market, the existing price level, and all other considerations on the financial difficulties that the world finds itself in is of course built on the fact that we do believe India will be one of those continents in the world that as rapidly as possibly can be one of those drivers that takes the world a step further. Today we can read in the Financial Times that the government of India has revised their economic growth figure for 2008 to 2009 to 7.1%, whereas we are putting in our estimates that more in line of 5% would be the case for economic growth in 2009. And whether it's 5 or 7, whether it's recovered in 2010 and 11 at the pace of what the prognosis is saying, everyone seems to be of the belief that India will be one of those continents in the world that will be able to recover sooner than later in this in the turmoil that we're seeing in the world because of the financial crisis. With all these aspects in hand, and with the necessary next steps before closing, we think we have a feasible project which we are going to execute upon according to the parameters that Sigve has just described to you in his presentation. And with these words, we are through with our presentation this afternoon here from Fornebu. I will then ask Sigve and Trond to join me here at the table for question and answers. And we're ready to embark on that part of this presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Fredrik and Sigve. We will now open up for questions. As Fredrik said, due to time restraints, we may have to limit the number of questions. In that case, please don't hesitate to contact Investor Relations for additional questions. We will first open for questions from the audience present here at Fornebu. Before we open up for those participating on the phone. Please introduce yourself before asking the question. No questions? Well, the first one I think is Martin Hoff, Arctic. Second, third row.
The point about applying to be able to increase your ownership to 74% in Intech Wireless, is that because of your view of risks of your partner not being able to contribute their potential equity stake? And also relating to that, how is the shareholder agreement with Unitech structured? What price would you be diluting them at?
First of all, it's not triggered by that. The application is triggered by the foreign investment regime in India, where foreigners are allowed to own up to 74%. Between 49 and 74%, you need an approval. So it's only geared by that. And as to a potential dilution factor, that is not sort of spelled out in our material.
Regarding your share of net adds, is that net adds in the areas you have footprint, or is that net adds from total Indian markets?
No, that's definitely net adds in the area where we have footprint. So the figures here are is a sum of the go-to-market strategy that we have, which is aligned then with our overall strategy.
Next question is Espen Torgersen, Canadian.
I have a question on ARPU. I must say I'm somewhat intrigued by your outlook, how that's going to trend, and especially given the historic trends we've seen elsewhere in Asia. Is it fair to say that the predominant reason for that is the spectrum constraints, or are there specific issues in India or certain circles that would indicate that ARPU should suddenly turn and have a very delightful move from here on?
Well, let's say two comments to your question. There are four main parameters why we believe in this ARPU. And the first one is definitely what you already said, the spectrum constraints. There is no way that existing operators can significantly drop the prices or can give away a lot of free minutes. There's simply not spectrum enough to allow that. Secondly, so the price levels we have seen in India is already so low that it's the lowest in the world. So we don't see that the prices are going to fall further. And we actually see some price elasticity in the market, other than new elasticity, where people then balance low prices with actually increased usage. And then you have the VAT component of the very low data proportion of revenues, only 3-5%, which we think will go up to the more Asian standard of 10-15%. The reason, the shape of the curve, which was the second question, it's our belief in the GDP growth, and also in our belief in the growth of mobile spending as percentage of total GDP, as I explained. And if you combine that all together, then you get this both the ARPU level and the shape of the curve as explained.
I may just follow up on that. Looking at how you've gone to the market elsewhere and what you've been successful in doing, obviously the price elements have been very, very important. Quality, i.e. CapEx, and price, i.e. price discounts. Doesn't that put you in a somewhat strenuous situation, given that you can't play with the price elements to the same degree? And obviously the CapEx, here is the question I won't touch upon.
Well, it's not totally true what you say, because in Pakistan, for example, price was not the main element when we launched. And if you look in Pakistan today, you will see that the Telenor Pakistan ARPU is slightly below the market leader, but it's actually above the industry standard. In Pakistan, the market position we have taken is more on quality, it's on services, it's not on price. Same in Digi, if I take another example, also coming from a very low market share number as we had some few years ago as a number three player, coming up to where we are today, it has not been priced. Digi is actually priced higher than their competitors. So the other mechanism that we have been using. And this other mechanism we are going to use in the market as well. So I wouldn't say that's going to give us some disadvantage. And that's why I talk so much about the distribution. Why I talk about the CRM solutions, and why I also talk about segmentation of the market. Also, there are other things and size they're going to play on.
And the next question is from Frank Moore, General.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. I have a follow-up question on the ARPU prognosis. And that relates to your arguments, really, regarding you mentioned Sigma, that spectrum is the number one argument, and Cedric also mentioned that. Now, what we have seen in the market like Bangladesh, for instance, is that given the scarcity of spectrum that's been there before you just received the new spectrum, there's been a proliferation of base stations, with a very high density, which has led to very high capex and a low cash flow in that market. Don't you see the risk of further densification of base stations when the incumbents try to defend their market share, or the new entrants coming in, other than Telenor, comes in here also with fresh spectrum? So, I mean, to your argument on the spectrum scarcity, there is both 2G and new 3G spectrum coming into India, and you have the option of base station proliferation, and with much more density being used. That's my question regarding that point.
Well, I think what we're going to see in India, it's more likely a consolidation at a certain point in time. The rule for the new entrants is that you have to, you cannot consolidate anything before 3 years after you go to license, which means another 2 years. And I think that the bigger operators will need more spectrum in one way or another. And rather than going for increased density, as you just mentioned, I think they were going to go for consolidation. So I think that the Indian market is going to look very different in 3 to 4 years' time. That's, I think, the way they're going to solve this. People are also saying that the bigger operators are going to go for 3G just to get spectrum, but that's not so simple. First of all, it's very expensive. 3G auction in Pan-India is going to be extremely expensive. Secondly, you cannot use this without your customer changing handsets. And in the lower end market, that's not going to happen that easily. So I think that it's more likely that you will see consolidation as it is to deal with the spectrum problem in the longer run.
But I see your RQ graph is basically bottoming out in 2009, and that's before, you know, the three-year period you're referring to.
It is what?
I mean, you're referring to consolidation after the three-year period from the new licenses?
Yeah.
But your RQ graph is kind of bottoming out already this year. So you don't see the risk of this new spectrum coming in now over the next 3 years. As a threat to your RPU forecast.
Well, that's back to my other argument, which is that the price level is very, very low already. And I really don't think that a market leader like Bharti, for example, with 90 million or 100 million customers, would dare to even think about reducing the prices. Not because their interest is to protect what they already have. And then lowering the prices in a market where the churn is so high, what people just do, they throw away the SIM card and buy a new SIM card with the same operator. And there is no way they're going to risk that. So I'm not really concerned about the price level significantly dropping further in the market.
If I may follow up on the offer then, if you move from the pricing to the MOU, you say that there's a low penetration in the market, obviously. And what we typically seen then in other markets is that when you move to, as penetration moves upwards the curve, you typically see incremental ARPUs, you know, much lower than the ARPUs we see here today. And with rapid growth in India, don't you see the threat of ARPU being diluted by, you know, rural low income users?
Absolutely, but that leads into the other argument that you have to also look at the GDP growth in India, which is much higher than in comparable markets like Bangladesh or Pakistan, for example. We are talking about GDP figures 5 to 6 to 7 to 8%, and we also talk then about a high proportion of the revenues, of the percentage of the GDP coming from mobile spending. So that's the balance against what you say, and that's why we believe in this output curve moving forward.
But on the other hand, we have to add that we do expect that in the initial period, when we are sort of starting to build customers, then we're not at that curve immediately.
And just to clarify on the structure of the graph you're looking at, Frank, it's even though the steepness in the downturn, actually, we believe that it's actually going to slow down, and basically has been slowed down. We actually still see a decline for another 2 to 3 years in that graph. Even though, and in addition, this is a graph in nominal Indian rupee, considering also the element of inflation. So if you take all those elements and add on the level of GDP growth, I do think that you're at least going to see a different equation in India than some of the other relevant markets.
But just maybe one clarification. After the ARPU that we showed you here is what we believe is the industry ARPU. And we will be a little bit lower than that in the beginning, of course, when we are introducing all the services. Then, after 2-3 years' time, we see that we will be very close to the industry ARPU.
Thank you.
One more question from Martin Hoff, I think.
Yes, I was wondering, do you view your establishment in Pakistan as a financial success, considering that you've spent $8 to $9 billion in cash in Pakistan and maybe worth 4 to 5 today?
Well, you're absolutely right that as things are standing today, measured by sort of mid-February 2009, there is a discrepancy on market consensus on valuation for Pakistan, as it is for a number of other assets around in the world in under the present circumstances. And our view is, of course, that there is a future here which goes beyond the existing features of the present valuation parameters. That we have that optimism in what we're doing.
Any additional questions from the audience here at Fonda? No questions. In that case, I will ask for the conference host to introduce the first question on the phone.
Thank you. The first question is from Maurice Patrick, J.P. Morgan. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Maurice here from J.P. Morgan. On the conference call earlier this week, you talked a lot about financing of the group and cash flow through lower capex and your financing position. There's clearly a large amount of money you're about to spend in India, and people are very concerned about the magnitude of it and if it runs out of control. Can you talk about what you will do in a scenario where your core businesses change, whether it's inflation or growth or capex driven? Will you cut back on your rollout plan in India, or how will you deal with that if things actually change? And otherwise put, if in India things don't go according to your plan, say ARPUs are lighter or your costs are higher, would you scale back on your plans until you resolve them or keep plowing ahead? Thank you.
Well, Maurice, as we said, the element, we updated the guidance on the cash flow as well as the guidance on 2009. We uphold the guidance on when it comes to the capex spending the first 3 years, or the first period of 12 billion in Norwegian kroner, where we earlier estimated the 2 billion US dollars. We uphold the ETA break-even of 3 years after launch. We also uphold the cash flow break-even of 5 years. But considering your question and say that the world doesn't really go forward as we foresee right now, will we cut back? Well, India is a greenfield. In the period of 18 to 24 months, when the roll-up period is going, to get up to the 40,000 sign and a decent coverage, I do think that that plan is very much set. I don't think that we will say very much deviance on that part, because it's too early in the stage, too much investment capacity that has to be driven. So in that regard, I do think that India has to go for a period of time before we actually reallocate the position. Not that we, if something dramatically happens, of course we will, but the element is, in general, that is not the type that Telenor does greenfield operation. So in that sense, that will be stick to relative to how we see the development. When it comes to the other part, as I said, we have done the scenario thinking, and when we did review and guiding on the revenue level, it's of course a more uncertainty level, and we have our hands on that topic every week. So the element is, will we then adjust other parts relative to that? That is too difficult to say, and that priority has to be taken if in case that arrives.
Okay, thank you.
Next, Stefan Pettersson, Nordea. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hello, Stefan Pettersson, Nordea. Let me follow up on the earlier question from Maurice Patrick. You say you have a 20-year tower sharing agreement. If you, some years down the road, see differently on India, at what terms can you exit the agreement?
Let me begin on that. It's so that the vendor is committed to supply to us. And we have in replicate a commitment over a shorter period of time. Sigurd?
No, that's correct. I cannot disclose all the commercial details in the agreement, but it's a significant shorter time than the 20 years that we are locked up upon. And when we say 40,000, exit the 40,000, there's a significant lower number that we have committed to. So we have an option to go up to 40,000. We have also then an option to go with someone else. Or we have an option to take a few numbers and also then go out for the agreements in some years. But more details on that we cannot give.
That's fine. Thank you.
Next, Shabhan Magamber, Macquarie Capital. Go ahead, please.
Hello, gentlemen. Thanks for the opportunity for asking this question. I have three or four questions. My first question is, are you basing any of your financial objectives and outcomes based on mobile number portability being
I can answer that question. Yes and no. We expect the number portability to come in the market in the third quarter. And that's when we also plan to launch our service. And we are definitely going to try to get the high-end customers that want to keep their number, that have a better quality. But in terms of the numbers, both subscriber numbers and financial numbers, this will not be a major part. The major part is from the prepaid segment, where we see that number portability is not that significant.
And your views on termination and interconnect charges, because you do mention that on your slides, do you have a view either way on it being revised? And is that material to achieving your financial objectives?
I didn't really understand the question on this.
Okay, the termination interconnect charges regime in India that is currently in place, which is on your slide 43.
Yeah.
Do you have a view either ways of these numbers or rates being revised downwards or upwards? And if you do have a view, do they have a material impact on achieving your financial objectives of 3-year and 5-year break-evens?
Yeah, we have a view on this, of course. But in the outlook we give, it's based on the current prices. And we have some views on how that may develop in the future. But that's not reflected in the outlook that we give.
Right. Thanks. My second question is, you harped on the point of minutes of use for incumbent GSM operators being high, and the fact that they cannot drop prices and rely on higher minutes of use because they are capped out on 2G spectrum. And in absence of 3G, there is very little headroom they have incrementally to keep relying on higher and higher minutes of use. I don't think that the same would apply to you with 4.4 megahertz spectrum on the GSM, or even if you go up to 6.2 megahertz. What would be your differentiator in the market as the 8th or 9th operator, other than being able to offer free network in possibly the first year? Because the way I look at it is, you will probably get capped out on your 2G spectrum at 4.4 or 6.2 megahertz because India will basically, spend up all of its 2G spectrum in the next 1.5 years.
Well, first of all, you are right. When we are successful, not if, but when we are successful, we will also, of course, face some spectrum challenges. But up to that point in time, we will have a huge advantage because we have more or less an empty network that we can provide much much better quality services than the incumbents. As you know, it's very regulated when you get access to more spectrum. It's regulated both in terms of number of subscribers and also on the traffic growth. So when we come to that, of course, we will face some of the same problems. We have a little bit advantage with the GSM equipment that we get on board now. This GSM equipment is the newest and the latest, and it's actually more spectrum efficient than the GSM equipment that our competitors are using. So there's a small advantage of that one. How big that one, I cannot quantify. But after some while, we need other things to differentiate us on than having an empty network. And that's where I'm talking about distribution, segmentation, and so on.
Do you have a view when or at what level of subscribers or what level of spectrum you will hit a cap in terms of 2G spectrum availability? Do you think you will be able to, get capped out at 6.2 megahertz of spectrum, largely speaking, in spite of continuously getting higher levels of subscribers, simply because India will not have any more 2G spectrum? Do you think that number is 4.4 megahertz or 6.2 megahertz or 7 megahertz? What is your view?
Well, we have some views on this, but it's also a little bit related to the consolidation play that I just mentioned. And I don't think I want to go into details on how we see this to be played out in the coming few years. There are far too much uncertainty involved.
We have many questions in line. I think we have, after you have answered this question, we have to proceed to the next question.
Sure. Can I ask one last question?
As I said, I think we would have to proceed to the next one. We have so many in line.
Thank you.
The next, Andrew Hoglin from Execution. Go ahead, please.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. I'd like to go back to the tower sharing agreement, if I could. You said you wouldn't give any figures on what payments you're committed to, but will the credit rating agencies treat any liabilities there as debt? Is that something you've discussed with them? And staying on that theme, do you expect that you will have to take a further credit rating downgrade? And if you do, what is the absolute floor level that you would accept?
Well, the element of that is that we have informed the rating agency of our business case in India, and as of such, we do not expect them to adjust their updated rating as they have done off the new year. So in that sense, most of their commitments, as well as the peak funding, the business plan with the different break-even levels, they have been introduced to those numbers. So we do not expect that.
And as a follow-up, are there any of the established operators that you think you can take market share from in particular?
Well, that's going too far into much detail and also disclosing too much of our go-to-market strategy. But when the churn is already 50%, of course this 50% is coming from the existing players. So we are going to go after these churners.
Thank you.
Next, Sandeep Mathew, BNP Paribas. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. I have three questions here. The first, what is the debt on the balance sheet of Unitech Wireless currently? And do you plan to substitute the debt with foreign currency debt? The second is, how much is the total cash outflow that will go to the Unitech parent company? And finally, are there any further obligations on the part of Unitech for the deal to close? Thank you.
I believe that, I don't remember the number actually, but I believe that the net debt in Unitech is approximately 400
million.
Unitech Wireless is 400 million. Of that, some will be converted to equity. So I do think that after the conversion and the total capital increase that Telenor is going to do, I believe that the net debt as a starting point will be around $250 million.
Yeah, I can confirm this. I think the second part of your question was that it's...
what is the total cash on
It's going to be a shareholder loan that is going to be repaid to UTEC Limited. But that's the only part that is going to UTEC Limited. The rest is going into the company.
Sure. So is that 5 billion or is that 7.5 billion rupees?
I said 50 million US.
Okay. And are there any further obligations on Unitech front for the deal to close?
Oh, well, there are a lot of housekeeping condition precedents outstanding. Other than that, we do foresee that the housekeeping and not anything else.
Thank you.
Mr. Jacob Bluestone, Merrill Lynch, go ahead, please.
Hi there, Jacob Bluestone from Merrill Lynch. I've got three questions. Firstly, if I just come back to slide 14 with the expected market ARPU, I accept the points that you're making about prices being low and spectrum constraints and so on, but correct me if I'm wrong here, are you basically saying that you're expecting 10 years of price stability in India? Because that would be pretty unprecedented. My second question is, you mentioned in response to an earlier question that you are assuming some ARPU, I guess, supporting whatever degree of price stability you assume in India. And can you just tell us how your inflation expectations factor into your currency assumptions? Because presumably that would put pressure over currency over time when you're doing your sort of DCF for the business. And this is my final question. You mentioned that you expect to see some consolidation within the market eventually. I realize it's early, but do you eventually see yourself being one of the consolidators? Thank you.
Well, I think I can answer the first question. Now, while I didn't say a price stability, I said that most of the price reduction was taken out already.
So I don't expect the same significant price fall to happen in India as you have seen in some other markets. So it's not a price stability, but at least it's not a huge drop. And that will also be balanced with, as I said, a higher proportion of revenues coming from value-added services, which I expect then is somewhat balancing a potential pressure reduction on voice. The inflation figures, I don't think we have something.
Yeah, to talk to you, investor relations, I don't have that number, so I do think it's not a fixed number either. So.
And if I may add on the first point here, that the extreme price falls that we've seen in some markets, India included, through the last period, we have experienced that in Bangladesh in particular last year. And we have seen the effect of that on the ARPU figure. We've seen the question of the same type that we need today. And we've also seen that after periods of that, you reach a period of more stable prices because of the sheer fact that the price level comes down to a level where the long-term sustainability has to be questioned. Of course, this is not a 10-year statement. This statement will have to be revised with a period of time at the, each time we do it. On the consolidation side, I think it's fair to say to be in agreement with you that it's a long shot. So let's leave that to the future. Thank you.
So I just have one follow-up. What sort of price declines are you assuming? I don't know if that's something you're able to share with us. Thank you.
No, it's not. You need to just look at our ARPU assumption, and that's the combination of all the factors that I have said. So we cannot break these down into more detailed numbers.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Next, Jan Dawerski from Handelsbanken.
Thank you. A couple of questions. One, if you, at the initial presentation, you mentioned that India would take up 90%, would be cash flow dilution of 90% in 2009 and 40% in 2010. Obviously, the cash flow dilution in 2009 is now substantially lower, but can you give a perspective on that now?
Well, the cash flow dilution as a result is coming up in 2010 because, as we said, this is more due to the fact that we're closing late, that we're postponing elements. But as a result, we have also reduced the cash flow element as a result of reduced CapEx and OpEx costs in total. So it is coming down, but I actually don't have that number in front of me. So, but it's coming down, well, it's coming up from our last guiding on the 40%, but in total, the total decline is coming down. But I don't have any numbers to give you now.
Also, in terms of the potential consolidation, or if you will start, and so with a few other newcomers, and some are expanding into new circles, but is the business case, does that rest on the fact that there will only be 8 operators in India, and if so, what? How do you see the business case developing if you have 10 or 12 operators in India?
Well, the business case is developed on what we think we'll be able to do in each and all of these circles. So the business case is then a bottom-up business case where we add our go-to-market strategy in the circles as we see it as of now. We have not assumed that it will be a consolidation. We have not assumed that we've added one or two more players. We have just looked at what do we think we can do and what can be our position. And with the go-to-market strategy, what will then be our subscriber market share. So that's the way the business case has developed. So, as I said, it's not that interesting as to look at the number of players. If you just list them down, you have to look at what is the situation in each and one of the circles and how can we position ourselves here and how can we take market share in this circle. And then that is up.
But aren't you assuming that the other two or three that will thought at around the same time as you were starting that they will also fight for market share?
Of course. Well, it's yet to be seen how many of the four that got the license that actually are going to roll it out. Right now, as far as we read the papers and hear from the market, it's ourselves and Swarm with a lot of the players that may come. What the situation is with the two others, it's yet to be seen. At least it seems like there will be slower and later entrants than ourselves.
Also, that's the final question. If you can comment on that, but in terms of on the initial rollout and the launch, should we see you focus on the A and the B circuits at the initial stage? Is that how we should read your comments in terms of what to focus on?
I don't think I want to. I don't think I want to give you an accurate answer to that. That's disclosing too much of our strategy. What I can say is that we are launching in many circles by third quarter. How many and which circles, I don't want to disclose.
Okay, thank you.
Next, Atash Shah, Nomura, India.
Thank you for taking my question. My question is, how much of additional equity would you expect to inject until your operating cash flow breakeven?
Was that the timing of the operating cash flow breakeven? If that was so, we said that it's five years from launch where we believe that we're going to be operational breakeven.
Yes, but how much of additional equity would you need to inject by that point of time?
Well, as we said on one of the slides, we said that the estimated peak funding at the at that point in time should be 22 billion Norwegian kroner. That is equivalent, I don't remember, around 160 billion Indian rupees.
Yes, but that would be
160
billion of equity, right?
The question is how much of the additional is expected to be equity?
Well, that is, as Fredrik said, I mean, we have committed our part of equity. We believe that we're going to have some project financing, and that really depends on how much of project financing we're actually able to make from the domestic banks in India. We do not expect that additional equity to be substantial. If in case it were to come, late, or mid-late 2010, beginning 2011, but we don't see that as a substantial number coming in.
And just in case Unitech is unable to commit their pro rata share of the additional equity needed, would you be open to picking up an additional 14% stake in Unitech Wireless, or would you like a third partner to come in and do that?
We have The consideration is so that we expect Unitech to meet their part of the potential new equity that's needed in the time frame that John described. And if that question arises, then we will consider that question at the time.
Okay, thank you.
Next, Leon Johansson from Blackwood. Go ahead, please, Mr. Johansson. The next is Anders Danberg from RAM, R-A-M.
Hello. Congratulations at least to lowering the cost 2009. Back to John Dolphus' question, can you give us any more feeling for the cash flow dilution in 2010? And secondly, the 22 billion in negative operating free cash flow until cash flow break even. What is the definition of that? Is it just the EBITDA minus CapEx, or is it also interest rates and taxes and other things included? Thank you.
Well, in the peak funding is, of course, the financing cost included, because we do going to have some project financing sitting on the books of the subsidiary, and thereby the peak funding is going to be a part of it.
Okay. So your EBITDA minus CapEx will be less than 22 then?
That is then correct, yes. And the element of that is of course also that as part of the funding is also going to be vendor financing relative to these capex. And to your question on cash flow guidance on 2010, no, I haven't been given any more information since 10 minutes ago, so that is going to be difficult.
Okay, thanks.
Next, James Britton from Nomura. Go ahead, please. Next, Samit Dasar from New Street Research.
Hi, Sumit at New Street. Can I just go back to the project financing question? Could you perhaps talk a little bit about the appetite for project financing at the moment in India, and maybe talk about what you see as an optimal level of net debt in Unitech Wireless? Thank you.
Well, the element of project financing in India is, as we see it now, still available. We do believe that the financial institutions in India do have the capability of project financing when it comes to infrastructure projects. We also know that they have some priorities in India relative to that to infrastructure projects, and we have been in discussion with numerous institutions already, so that we believe that I wouldn't give you a number, but a fair amount of project financing subsequent to equity being injected in the Unitech Wireless would be available for us as soon as the project is ongoing and the likelihood of the project being supplied to the financial institution. How much the gearing ratio should be on that company, it's a continuous discussion that we want to have with the Unitech Group, and that is really dependent on how the project financing is working out, as well as the vendor financing is working out, and looking at that. So we don't have a guidance on that as of now.
I have time for one last question on the phone.
Mr. Sunil Patel from Morgan Stanley, go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. I just have a couple of short questions, actually. One is, would you consider launching Circle by Circle and essentially de-risking the whole project, or is your plan more of a sort of nationwide launch? You know, you talk about many circles, what that means. Secondly, is on the pricing. I know we've been around this quite a lot now, but putting it in a slightly different way, do you think it's realistic the pricing could fall by around 30% in the next 2 years? Because the reason I ask is you've seen people like Idea launching in Bombay pretty low prices trying to get access to additional spectrum. So does that sound reasonable? And the final thing is, you know, what is your view on in terms of consolidation? Because in 3 years' time, it's not entirely clear if M&A is indeed allowed before that, but even after that, if the rules change, would that change your business plan, or is it completely decoupled from that?
The first question, I think what I want to say about that, going back to one of the slides I had, I said that we are going to launch with a 40% population coverage. That's approximately 20,000 base stations. Then I said that shortly thereafter we are going to go up to 30 and 50%, whereby during next year, 2010, we will have 40,000 base stations and a 60% coverage. So that's, I don't want to give any more detail on our launch strategy than that. So it means definitely that when we launch in the third quarter, it's going to be one of our circles, it's going to be enough to cover 40% of the population, and then we follow up thereafter. The price, well, it's difficult to give an exact percentage answer to your question. What I say is that I don't foresee any major price war or any price is going to happen. Maybe some, but nothing major. And again, this will also be balanced by higher usage of value-added services, and also somehow be balanced with maybe an increase in use of use. And that's why we believe in the ARPU figure here. So I don't want to say yes or no to that percentage, but I don't foresee any major drop in the prices. the data prices are very, very low already. The last question, I think that's a little bit too 3 years in a row, what will happen there and how we see that, I think that's a little bit too far-fetched to answer.
The one thing is, can be said, and that is that in every market there will be a change in the parameters and the framework for this industry. We're used to that from all the markets in which we are. There are new events, competition and market development decides what kind of ambition authorities in countries will be setting for their telecommunication policies. And we are well familiar with how to work with authorities in respect of discussion, as well as seeing changes coming. The number one vital parameter in that respect is that it is a transparent development as well as a level playing field principle at the bottom of it.
Let me just add to that. Having experience from the regulatory situation in all five different Asian countries, I must say that the Indian regulator is very shared to firm and is also really promoting competition. So I don't see any favors being given to the incumbents. It's actually the other way around, trying to make room for newcomers to come into the market. And this is one of the positive parameters we actually see when we move into a country like India, the regulatory framework.
These words from Signal completes the Q&A session. Thank you all for attending this presentation today. I hope you have found it useful. If you have additional questions, please don't hesitate to contact Investor Relations. Thank you.